Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Donald Trump won the election by almost 2,285,000 votes. A Republican has not won the popular vote since 2004. Donald Trump gained ground in Democratic states and picked up a lot of support from young voters and voters of color. Here in California, Kamala Harris defeated Trump 58.5% to 38%. But she did much worse than Joe Biden did in 2020, according to CalMatters. Kamala Harris lost votes in all but one of the state's 58 counties, including several with sizable Latino populations, and she lost at least 10 percentage points of the vote in 43 counties. So how did Trump do it? Research by Celinda Lake found that Biden voters who did not vote for Harris said she failed to address issues like poverty and inequality. Yale professor Daniel Hosang's research shows that Democrats lost the record numbers of non-white voters who put Obama in the White House because Democratic policies have failed them. So are Democrats listening? If you'd like to join today's conversation, what are your thoughts about what we have learned since the election? And if you have any questions about the numbers, now that so much research has been done, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have voted for Democrats in the past but did not this time, there are a lot of people who just didn't vote at all. They did not want to vote for Trump, but they didn't vote. If you have anyone in your family or in your circle who have voted for Democrats but either voted for Trump or did not vote, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by three guests. Celinda Lake is president of Lake Research Partners, a national public opinion and political strategy research firm she founded in 1995. Celinda Lake was one of the Democratic Party's leading political strategists and was one of two lead pollsters for Joe Biden's 2020 presidential campaign. Celinda Lake is co-author of two books, What Women Really Want and A Question of Respect, Bringing Us Together in a Deeply Divided Nation. Hi, Celinda. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on.
It's great to have you. Celinda Lake conducted her polling for the group Way to Win, and we're joined by Tori Gavito, president of Way to Win. It's a strategic donor collaborative that invests in data-driven strategies to fund new media and grassroots efforts to win long-term political change. Tori Gavito was founding executive director of the Texas Future Project, and her career is inspired by her grandmother and namesake, who immigrated to Texas from Mexico in the 1940s. Hi, Tori. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here.
Great to have you. Daniel Martinez Hosang is professor of American Studies and Political Science at Yale University and co-editor of the forthcoming book, The Politics of the Multiracial Right. Professor Hosang wrote a recent New York Times opinion piece that got a lot of attention, Inside the Rise of the Multiracial Right. He's been studying the movement of non-white voters to the right for 15 years. And in that New York Times piece, he writes that Trump nearly doubled his support among Black voters from 2020 to 2024, won some 40% of the Asian American vote, and took almost half of the Latino vote. Hi, Daniel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rose, for the invitation. Really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, it's great to have you. It's great to have all of you. There are so many numbers out there, and a lot of them are very different. So based on the research that you've all done, Celinda, let's start off with you. Can you tell us how many people did not vote who voted for Obama and Biden? And then how many do we know how many Obama and Biden voters voted for Trump?
The study that we did didn't look at the Obama voters. It looked at the Biden voters and the Biden skippers. And there are several million that switched their vote. And then there are over 6, and some estimate as high as 9 million voters who skipped the ballot. Wow. And Way to Win did the most in-depth study of that. And I want to really commend Tory for the vision of doing these Biden skippers, because conventional wisdom was completely wrong about them. Conventional wisdom was they don't pay attention. They were paying a lot of attention. Conventional wisdom is they would have voted for Trump. No, they would have voted overwhelmingly for Biden, and they would vote Democratic still. They despise Trump. But they did feel, as you said in your introduction, that the Democrats did not. It isn't even that the policies failed. They don't think any policies were really offered, just a lot of rhetoric. And in the current environment, as Way to Win has said, they want people to fight, not fold.
So as many as 9 million people who voted for Biden did not vote for Harris?
Yeah, 6 to 9 million.
That's a massive number. I mean, especially it's when huge. You think
it's
about...
enough voters. Actually, it's enough voters to have won Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Michigan. Wow. It was the deciding factor in the election.
Celinda, I don't like these questions because there's no way to know. But given that you've been at this for a very long time, do you think Biden would have won if he stayed in the race?
Oh, I think it's really hard to say. Plus, I think that the Democratic Party was so divided and was running such an, you know, was saying so many negative things about him, it made it impossible.
Right.
So I think it's hard to know if people had united around Biden, whether that would have been possible or not. But I think that this is not just rooted in one candidacy. As Tory has said repeatedly, this is rooted in a long-term problem of the Democrats not offering economic alternatives for people and not producing economic differences in their lives. And if there isn't an economic reason to vote for Democrats, people aren't going to vote for Democrats.
Before we go to Tory, can you tell us, what is a Biden skipper?
A Biden skipper were the missing Biden voters. These were people who voted for Biden in 2020 and did not vote in the 2024 presidential elections.
Okay. These numbers are so high, Tory. What really struck you about Celinda's research? And given that there's different numbers and different stories, what do we need to know now that we're almost a year out of the election, given all of the research that's been done?
Right. So politics is a game of addition. And so we're looking to get more voters than the other side. And frankly, we think it's probably a good first use of time, but not the only use of time, to think about those voters who have voted for a Democrat in the past, in the most recent past, of course, that being the 2020 election. And so that's why we started there. Who voted for Biden in 2020 and didn't show up in 24? And when you add those millions, I know you and Celinda have been knocking around some numbers. Some estimates put it at even higher than 9 million, but that's not here nor there. It's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. When you add that with what we know about people that also flipped sides, that's where you really see some real challenges. And so we're looking at these folks because we know that we have to persuade them. We have to understand what's happening in their lives. And what they're telling us overwhelmingly is that life is too dang expensive. It is really difficult to not just get ahead, but just have some stability in their economic conditions. And the thing I want to really make clear for any political strategists listening or for folks that are trying to unpack is it's not enough for a candidate today to talk about the affordability issues, although that's a good start. You have to start naming why. Because if all we do is say, life is tough, life is tough, life is tough, enter Trump and he'll say, you know why life is tough? Well, it's that immigrant over there. Or you know why life's tough? It was China. That's why we need tariffs. And so you need a little bit of solution setting too, and naming why things are difficult. And in our research, the skippers, who are these, had been Biden voters, overwhelmingly believe that our problems in our country, our affordability problems in our country, come from an economic system where the richest 1% have taken over $50 trillion from 90% of Americans over the past few decades. And it has nothing to do with, wokeness or immigration per se. It has to do with that fundamental unfairness in our economic systems. And there's a real path here then. So it shows Democrats, you know, if you're going after tax cheats, if you're talking about price gouging, this is a way you can capture these skippers' imaginations.
Hmm. I'm glad you brought this up, because think about how many times we've heard of wokeness in the last couple of years. And the American Prospects' Robert Kuttner wrote about your findings, and he writes that in battleground states, 77% of 2020 Biden voters who stayed home in 2024 felt that the nation's top problem was the top 1% taking too much at the expense of everyone else. Only 13% felt the main problems were government spending too much, out of control immigration, or quote, wokeness. And yet, Tory, if you did an analysis of media coverage, I mean, these are the issues that probably would be toward the top.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad we're talking about this a little bit. One of the things that I found interesting from Daniel's research, actually, I'm excited to be on the call with you, Daniel, is this idea that the Republicans make really welcoming spaces where people of color, even people from the LGBTQ community, everybody's sort of invited in to talk about what they think is the challenge with the country. That the way the media focuses on wokeness and the way the Republicans actually construct welcoming spaces are really in contradictory, they're really in contradiction. So it's a reminder to us to just stand in our values. Democrats need to stand in their values and project a fight for the future. The skippers overwhelmingly tell us they want people who will fight for them, not fold. And so this means, you know, not retreating from any value statement about who should be in our coalition. In fact, we should be welcoming everyone in our coalition. That's how you get to this game of addition, like I mentioned at the top. But you have to be able to show you're fighting for them.
Tory Gavito is president of Way to Win, a strategic donor collaborative. And Way to Win and Celinda Lake took a look at the Biden skippers and found that, gosh, as many as 9 million or maybe even more voted for Biden but did not vote it for Harris. And they took a look at why that was the case. Daniel Martinez Hosang is professor of American Studies and Political Science at Yale. And he has been studying the movement of non-white voters to the right for 15 years. Daniel, just reading these numbers, it's so easy to forget just how much ground Trump made with voters of color. He doubled his support among Black voters from 2020 to 2024, won 40% of the Asian American vote, and took almost half of the Latino vote. So given that you've been at this for a long time, tell us about some of the other research we should be thinking about right now.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it is startling to think that it's only 12 years ago, Obama's his second inauguration, he, you know, wins something like 80% of voters of color nationally, a high point for Latino voters, a high point for Black voters. And it seemed like that coalition was just permanent. And even the Republicans at the time, you know, Mitt Romney had a famous, after that campaign, GOP autopsy, and said, we are out of touch. Young voters, voters of color, think of us as old, backward looking, not connected to their issues. In 12 years, you know, we have both a president, a candidate in three successive cycles, and a president who's gone so far to the right and doubled down all these demonizations. And these voters, larger and larger shares of voters of color, have followed him. And that was these are the questions that animates my research and the work of my colleagues. I'll just a couple of things to add. I mean, one, I want to say what Celinda and Tory are talking about, those messages, I think those would have resonated with many of the voters of color who went to the right. That's precisely what they want people to speak to, is their day-to-day bread and butter material issues. Mm-hmm. And because for this piece, many of the voters I talked to, Black voters in Milwaukee, Asian American voters in San Francisco, Latino voters in South Texas, those are areas that have long had Democratic leadership at the state and local level, especially. So the sense when life feels tough in the way we've described, you feel like you're falling farther and farther behind, that's who immediately they associate with. with it. And it's certainly true there's not one failing Democratic policy to blame for it. But if we just think about San Francisco, the sky-high cost of housing, the terrible impact of the addiction crisis, this kind of speeding up and the feeling left behind, those are not just small policy reforms we can get together. That requires broad, broad visions to address. And I think that's precisely what people are waiting for.
What sort of themes did you find? What I love about your work is that, especially in this New York Times piece, you interview people and give them space to tell their story. It's not just a soundbite. So based on what the people that you interviewed, what were some of the themes that came out? The people who have voted Democrat in the past, but voted for Trump this time.
Yeah. I mean, let's take, you know, the Black voters and voters in Milwaukee I spoke to. You know, many of them have said around that they've, you know, the segregation and abandonment of their public schools, the impact of the housing crisis from 2012 on, many, many people lost their houses. All these out-of-town landlords came in and bought up properties and they never recovered that equity, the opioid crisis as well. So those are the day-to-day issues they're struggling with. And again, the sense was, and you know, just public institutions there have been eviscerated. Now, Republicans played a significant, significant role in doing that. But I think for these Black voters, their sense was, we just continue to give our vote to the Democrats every time, and our schools are in the same condition. We have no more prospects, better prospects for work. And even when they would express, you know, concerns about immigration, it was often through that lens. So not what I would call any kind of nativism or just, you know, dislike of immigrants, as much as they've been told, look, other people are getting in line ahead of you. You're the one who's been here and paid your dues. Why is that? And that has brought some folks over. I don't think the answer to that is to in any way double down on nativist politics, but I do think it's helpful to understand that as a lens through which they're even thinking through issues around immigration, for example.
You interviewed Tory Lowe in Milwaukee. He's 49, a radio host and community advocate who said, I voted for Obama. The energy was, let's see if we can get a brother in. So we had 8 years of Obama and the communities did not change. Our communities probably got worse. A lot of Black people are not MAGA. They're rejecting the Democrat leadership because of how they're running our communities. They need to take accountability for how they've mismanaged the Black communities. They're trying to continue to move forward fear-mongering against the Trump administration instead of saying, okay, let's redo and make it right. Daniel, given that you spoke with Tory and so many others, what's so important about this work, and you point this out in your piece, is that a lot of people just assumed that as the population became more diverse, the Democratic Party would win for generations to come. And Trump has shown us that that's just not the case. A lot of people, in some ways, are also shocked that people of color would vote for someone who is so openly racist and xenophobic. So what are your thoughts about those two issues?
Yeah. I mean, it just three quick things come to mind. First, the complaint that the Democratic Party, at least nationally, only pays attention to these voters around election time, and then you don't see them for another 2 to 4 years, that has long preceded this. And that often comes from progressive elements, community-based organizations in there. So the account of just electoral neglect outside of elections is not from the right. It actually comes from within those communities themselves. The second is that there has been a significant transformation, and not just the GOP, but right-wing groups like Turning Point USA, the Conservative Political Action Committee, to actually really build inroads. They're knocking on doors. They're actually talking about race, identity. Sometimes they talk about economic populism. So I think that assumption that these voters would never switch was also premised on the GOP itself and conservative groups didn't want them ever. And that's changed. They realize in swing states especially, they need those voters. And I'm not suggesting that they're delivering in any material way, but there is a real difference on the ground in how they're reaching out to them. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I'll just say is these voters are also, part of the reason I was so interested in the responses, they're talking about holding their elected officials accountable. They want to see better schools, better jobs, real change in their community. And in a two-party system, if their perception that the Democratic Party is not delivering it, and there's a revitalized Republican Party that's saying, we're the insurgent ones, we're where the energy is at, it's not surprising that at least some of them will go over there, and a larger number, as Celinda and Tory said, will stay home.
Daniel Martinez Hosang is professor of American Studies and Political Science at Yale University. He's been studying the movement of non-white voters to the right for 15 years. He wrote a New York Times opinion piece, Inside the Rise of the Multiracial Right. We're also joined today by Celinda Lake, president of Lake Research Partners, which she founded in 1995. She's one of the Democratic Party's leading political strategists. She conducted her polling for the group Way to Win, looking at why so many Biden voters did not vote this time. Tori Gavito is president of Way to Win, a strategic donor collaborative that invests in data-driven strategies to fund new media and grassroots efforts to win long-term political change. You can join us at 866-798-8255. Why do you think that Trump gained ground in so many Democratic states and picked up a lot of support from young voters and voters of color? If you have voted Democrat for a long time and you did not vote this time, or voted for Trump, or if you know anyone in your circle who did, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Let's take a few calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Michael in San Francisco. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. So one of the things I've kind of observed, it seems that the two major parties are beating the hammer, beating the drum for their own values without looking across and understanding what the values are of the voters on the other side and why those things are important to those people. So, like, for instance, Republicans, you know, have been making a big deal about immigration, whereas the Democrats are thinking, oh, my God, we're going to, you know, do all these horrible things to these people that are participating at, you know, important aspects of our economy. But for, I think, a lot of the Republican voters, the issue really is about having accessible entry-level employment. So for them, when they think of immigrants, they're not thinking about the people that are going out and collecting the produce that they're eating at dinner. They're thinking about people that they have to compete with in the job market, think like construction, for instance. And we've got, you know, a lot of economic turmoil going on. You know, if you don't have like a PhD in AI research, you know, where you're, you know, hot stuff for Google, a lot of people are really struggling to have a job that, you know, as mentioned earlier, gives them access to the American goods of housing.
So, Michael, we're almost to the break. So given that our guests today have done critical research with these voters, what would you like to hear from them?
What is actually important on the other side? So the people who went and voted Republican. So I hear, you know, talking about, you know, the schools have been really neglecting a lot of areas. The question is, you know, what are they going to, you know, propose to try to, you know, get those schools in better condition, for instance, people who didn't go to college, who for whatever reason, you know, that's not really a viable path for them to, you know, go and become white collar worker, which a lot of those jobs are under threat too. So trying to understand what is really important to the people who voted for Trump, who would have preferred to vote for a Democrat, who would be not creating a lot of disruption for the country.
Got it. Okay, thank you. Daniel, do you want to take that one, given that you talked to a lot of voters who voted for Democrats in the past and then voted for Trump this time?
Yeah, I think he raises a really, really important question, which is, I mean, all the messaging that we're talking about, the kind of economic populist addressing the explanations why we have such an out of kilter economy are important. But if the Democrats can't deliver and respond to those solutions and really meet them, that's what matters. And these apprehensions he's describing about the future of work, what's the relationship of education and getting credentialed to that, all of that is like, these are big, it's not just about messaging. So I think it's crucial. This is a two-part question. One is about the message and the candidates that'll connect with people, but the other is about what the solutions are. And if there are not real solutions behind those messages, voters will quickly turn, even if the messaging appeals to them and gets them to the polls.
And here's another comment from Shanna Gray in 46, cafe owner in Milwaukee, who said, in my cafe, I kept hearing from the African-American community how they were struggling not just to care for themselves, but care for their families and how much it was taking a toll on their very existence. We're all going through these changes with the fluctuation of the economy and we're just holding each other's hands while we get through this. Shauna Gray went on to say, for many, many years, we voted Democratic, but we have nothing to show for that other than the continued fight for civil rights. I'm tired of fighting. At this point, individuals like myself and others in my community were like, what do we have to lose? Because we feel like we're losing and we have nothing to lose to try something different. Celinda, that also sounds very similar to some of the Biden voters you interviewed who did not vote. I mean, they didn't vote for Trump, but they're very angry about their economic plight, saying that Democrats are just not talking about these issues around poverty, around inequality, affordable housing.
Well, the irony is, and both Katori and all of the speakers have spoken to this, 80% of the voters voted for the same thing. They voted for change, but there's good change and there's bad change. The problem is, for a lot of voters, Democrats didn't represent change. And they voted for the economy, and they voted, as Tori said very eloquently, the strongest testing statement in our polling was that the 1% have done well in this economy and left the rest of us behind or at the rest of ours expense. And Tori gave some incredible statistics on that. So people are voting for the same thing. And what the Democrats have to understand is this is not about a podcast. This is not about a message. This is about delivering. And this is about delivering real change and real economic improvement for real people's lives, including the caring economy, including good paying jobs, including taking on job loss with AI, including enhancing apprenticeship and after post high school programs. All of the things that your questioners and speakers have talked about. These are Democratic issues, and it's criminal that we are now still behind on the economy. Democrats have never won when they haven't been at least ahead or even on the economy. And in 2024, on Election Day, we were behind. So we either take that, deal with that, and take on and hold our donors accountable and our elected officials accountable, or we will become a permanent minority party.
Well, and to your point, we just did a Labor Day show yesterday, and according to the Economic Policy Institute, the Trump administration is taking steps to make most U.S. workers and their families substantially poorer in the coming years. And we'll talk more about this after a break, but Celinda, I mean, people's situations are just going to get worse under Trump for the most part. That's just a fact. If you look at the cuts that are happening, the states are now cutting their budgets because of what's going on at the federal level. So do you think that these non-voters, I mean, again, it depends on what the message is in 26, right? I mean, you say that they will vote for Democrats if the Dems talk about secure health insurance, making the rich pay their fair share of taxes, dealing with the cost of living and affordable housing.
Yeah, we have to, you can't beat something with nothing. And we have to offer an alternative, not just an alternative message, but an alternative plan. And we have to deliver on that alternative plan. One of the things I'm very excited about is that we have 30 attorney generals and 36 governor's races up in 2026. And each of these, I think, is a laboratory to demonstrate what democratic change looks like, what democratic economic policies look like. And people have lost faith in things being delivered at the federal level. We need to highlight our state and local successes if we're going to rebuild not just a message, but a plan to actually deliver change and improvement for real people's lives.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're talking about why millions of people who voted for Biden and Obama did not vote for Harris. And then we're also finding out why so many Democrats, especially people of color, voted for Trump. Today, we're joined by Celinda Lake, president of Lake Research Partners, Tori Gavito, president of Way to Win, and Daniel Martinez-Hosang, professor of American Studies and Political Science at Yale University. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. The This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our new series, The Authoritarian Playbook, by focusing on Donald Trump's firings and hirings. Cruz says the firings are an unprecedented attack on independent agencies and government accountability. And then on Thursday, we'll talk about a new book, Daybreak in Gaza, Stories of Palestinian Lives and Culture by Mahmoud Muna and Matthew Teller. And then on Friday, we'll be joined by Clay Risen, author of Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Today, we are finding out why so many people, 9 million or maybe more, who voted for Biden did not vote for Harris. We're also talking about Democratic voters who voted for Trump, specifically young people and people of color. Today, we're joined by Celinda Lake, president of Lake Research Partners. She took a look at the Biden voters who did not vote for Harris, and she conducted her polling for the group Way to Win. Tori Gavito is president of Way to Win. Daniel Martinez-Hosang is professor of American Studies and Political Science at Yale University. He's been studying the movement of non-white voters to the right for 15 years. He's got an op-ed in the New York Times called Inside the Rise of the Multiracial Right. Tori, before we get to calls, and we have so many calls and emails, what would you like to add about what it will take to get people who did not vote last time to vote again, given what they're about to experience under 4 years of Trump, and then the Democrats who voted for Trump, especially young people and people of color?
Right. I think this is just such, I know this is going to sound a little bit Pollyanna, but I think it's such an opportunity for Democrats moving forward to just blow up every playbook we've ever been taught is the playbook. That any reasonable person listening to this call, listening to the research, reading what we're reading about why there were Biden skippers or Biden flippers, it's quite rational and reasonable that people wanted to try something new and wanted to change candidate when conditions were as challenging as they've been. And looking forward, it's an opportunity for Democrats to just show what it means to fight for folks and rethink how to govern, not just how to bandwagon, not just how to electioneer, but how to actually govern. I think Celinda was so on point when she was pointing to blue states. Like blue state governors, the mayors, they're the ones with the power of the purse right now to show what it looks like to fight for people and to set up an economy that will work for people. I mean, clearly what we keep hearing over and over again from either the skipper research or the flipper research or the, you know, understanding the people that switch sides was that the status quo isn't working for anyone. People are telling us the status quo isn't working. And so why not lead looking forward? I'm thinking a lot about questions on housing and jobs. This is a chance for us to show what the future could look like. The caller isn't wrong pointing to shifts in the economy like the AI shifts. And so Democrats need to get in front of this, not behind it.
Well, we have a number of callers on the line, so let's take callers who've been waiting patiently, and then we'll get responses and then really talk about the future of the Democratic Party, because there's a lot of disagreement within the party right now about the approach that they're going to take. So let's hear from a number of callers. Let's go to John in Berkeley. Hi, John. Thanks for holding.
Okay. I never once heard Hillary Clinton mention working class issues or even the name working class when she ran for president against Trump. And other Democratic leaders in recent campaigns almost never mentioned the working class. It was always, we're going to do things for the middle class. It was as if they couldn't say the word working class. And one observation I have is if you've seen Spike Lee's recent film about Hurricane Katrina and what the devastation that affected the mostly black communities in New Orleans, they were all saying that the state and the Democratic Party in general have failed to address their needs for economic improvement, economic advancement, and they're all working class. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. We should do a show about that documentary. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's first go to Bill in Novato. Hi, Bill.
Thank you. Hi. Yeah, the campaign was just incredibly incompetent. There was not a word about climate change. I mean, it's the biggest issue in the world and everywhere. And Harris campaign said nothing about it. They got a great question in the second debate with Waltz's debate, and about just after Hurricane Helene, and he came off like he'd never heard of it. And she never said anything about it. They never said she never said anything about Trump calling the Georgia Secretary of State, and they actually had the audio of him telling the Georgia Secretary of State to give him 11,000 votes. I mean, incredibly, the guy should have gotten 20 years in prison for that. The Harris campaign never mentioned it, not in a debate, in interviews, never said anything about Gaza. You know, Netanyahu's trying to hold on to power and avoid prison, so he's, you know, bombing the crap out of all these human beings, and Harris campaign says nothing. That never supported Lina Khan, the progressive Federal Trade Commission head, who was, you know, wanted to put an end to the big monopolies that are screwing us all. Nothing about that. I mean, it was almost criminal how bad her campaign was. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. Let's go next to Jim in San Jose. Hi, Jim. Hi, do we have Jim? Let's try Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
I think this goes all the way back to Obama. Sorry about the feedback. I think that Obama really screwed so many.
Hey, Greg,
people.
Can you turn your radio down?
Yeah, just a second.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think Obama just left a lot of people high and dry, especially black people. With his policies, but getting closer to the present, look, in 2026, when this budget bill kicks in, we're going to find out just how many people are going to be satisfied with their vote for Trump. I think it's going to be a huge shock to a lot of people. And then thirdly, I have no idea what the Democrats could offer as an alternative. They talked about, and Biden made this reference to price gouging. What were they going to do? I mean, what are the Democrats going to do about affordable housing, health care, any of these other cost of living, the cost of food, gasoline, you name it? What are they going to do? Are they going to impose price controls? How are they going to take care of that?
A lot of people are wondering that, Greg. Thank you for the call. Let's go next to Graham in Baltimore. Hi, Graham. Welcome to the show.
My comments are mostly for the guest who's closely associated with the Democratic Party. I believe her name is Mrs. Lake, and it just has to do with the Democratic establishment is not coalescing behind the outrageously strong candidacy of Zoran Mamdani as mayor for New York, where it's becoming something of a national scandal that Democratic leading politicians are remaining quiet rather than endorse him or get behind him. Also, two popular congressional representatives, Cori Bush in Missouri.
Oh, did we lose you?
Hello?
Are you still there?
Hey, this is James. I'm just calling.
Uh-oh, I think we're having some phone issues. All right, well, we get that straightened out. I want to read a couple emails because we're getting a lot of emails from listeners, and then it would be great if you could all respond to the calls and emails. Kevin writes, I'm a 65-year-old grandson of a Holocaust survivor. I'm disgusted with Democratic leaders ignoring their constituents' desire to stop funding Israel's starvation of 2 million people. This violates the U.S. Leahy Law. Kamala Harris should have promised to uphold the U.S. and international law as it relates to Israel. She would not, and this explains why so many stayed home. Philip says, I think there is an entrenched and huge resentment against the class known as the elites, not the rich, but the very well-educated upper-middle-class liberals on the coasts. As long as those feelings, no matter how illegitimate, persist, Democrats will have difficulties winning the popular vote. This is a major factor in my view. And then I want to read one more email about someone who did not vote for Harris. Suzanne says, as a lifelong Democratic white senior citizen who proudly voted for every Democratic presidential candidate except for Bill Clinton, I could not vote for Kamala. She never told me how she would govern differently from Biden on issues that mean a lot to me, like Gaza. And then when she started campaigning with Liz Cheney, who I completely disagree with on everything, that was it. There was no way I could pull the lever for her. So there's a lot of comments there. Celinda, I think a lot of people would love to know, given that you are one of the Democratic Party's leading political strategists, how do the Democrats come up with not only their messaging, but their policies? Because people are saying the people who've been there for a long time are just out of touch with the struggles that people are facing on a day-to-day basis. And it's time to bring new people in, whether it's the politicians themselves or the people who work behind the scenes.
You know, I couldn't agree with you. I've got to listen to your show more and get a boost every day, because boy, do I agree with your listeners and every example that was given from Zoran to Israel, et cetera, I completely agree with. The Democrat Party is a big tent, but unfortunately, we're seriously divided now. Our clients tend to be progressives. They also tend to be organizations like Way to Win that are working for change and hold being elected officials accountable. We also work for the youngest female and the youngest male member of Congress, which people don't normally know about us, and a very diverse group of progressives. So I couldn't agree more. I think that often, I don't think the Democrats have appreciated the degree of trouble that we are in. And I don't understand, I don't know how much lower our ratings have to get before people do something different. As Bill Clinton said in 92, to do the same thing over and over again is the definition of insanity. I think that people have to really listen to organizations like Way to Win and Tory. In terms of getting into the grassroots, Way to Win has developed amazing social media communication that is just a groundbreaking innovation. And we need to be bold. We need to be fighters. We need to stand up. We need to offer an alternative. And I think your listeners are completely right. And right now, I think we're verging on people like your listeners abandoning the Democratic Party. I hope what you'll do is at the state and local level, take it over and produce the kind of changes we need.
Tori, what would you like to add?
I think the last point Celinda made is really important, the take it over, that the listeners are not wrong. I'm hearing every comment and thinking, yeah. and I think that it's a reminder that there is a kind of an archetype of an establishment Dem who, let's just be very clear, it's very expensive to run for office. It is an incredible money is a barrier to public office. And so as long as a Democrat who is rising the ranks is spending more time with people who can max out than spending time with their voter, that's where we get this Democrat who's afraid of their own shadows. And there's something that the Republican Party has done differently, where they have switched their focus away from some of their major donors and focus on their base. And it scared their major donors. Let's remember, like, this is an evolution that has come with time in the Republican Party, where people like Mitt Romney, for example, would have been very fearful of the rabble coming at the door. And it is that people, it is the energy that has brought new life to the Republican Party. I mean, whether we like it or not, it is energy, right? And so I would just encourage us, rather than thinking of the Democrats as a monolithic thing where there's one door, it is untrue. It is a space with many, many doors, whether at the local level, the state level, run for office, help volunteer, and don't stop writing checks to those Democrats that are inspiring you. So one of the callers mentioned Mamdani, who's of course running for mayor in New York City. There are other examples that are not, you know, New York City style candidates either, like Graham Plattner in Maine, a state Senate candidate in Iowa that just won, James Tallarico in Texas. You know, there's a ton of examples of a new generation of Democrats who understand their job is to build from the bottom up and take over the party over time. That's the way I see the way to win.
And Daniel, what would you like to add?
Yeah, I'd first really, really underscore the point Tori just made. You know, before the kind of MAGA wing of the Republican Party kind of came after both like wokeism, progressives, et cetera, they really first went after their own party. So think about, you know, 10, 15 years ago, people like Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, they said they kicked out in some ways their own establishment figures. And when I go to right-wing conferences now for my own research, I'm astonished at the number, the pathways and the pipelines into the right now. They've really taken seriously what it means to find a 22-year-old who's kind of newly awakened to their own concerns about the world, politicize them, and get them connected to a campaign. There's just far fewer examples of that in the Democratic Party. And you can think in California's own experience about Senators Boxer and Feinstein and many, many more examples of people holding on to those seats for a long, long time. And even while doing that, not really attending, just figuring out who they might want to anoint, but not thinking about building those pipelines into it, because there are more Mamdanis everywhere. Two other things I want to say. There's a lot of talk now about maybe buyer's remorse on the right among people that voted for Trump after the kind of devastating impact of the bill and these other policies might hit them. I think even if that happens, and it certainly will happen to some degree, these are not many voters who are going to realign themselves with the current form of the Democratic Party. It's going to, I think, deepen their cynicism, deepen their sense that everything is rigged against them, nothing is possible, and just to kind of put their own heads down. And I think that cynicism actually much more benefits Republican candidates than it does Democratic and progressive ones, who need people to have trust in institutions, trust in one another, believe in solidarity.
Are you planning to stay in touch with the people that you interview to find out what they're thinking, say, in a year and then 2 years?
Yes, absolutely. And because we're at these in these spaces all the time, I'll just say a couple of years into the first administration, when I said, so what do you think of the first 90 days or so? I was even taken aback. And part of what everyone said is, I have no problems with it. It's exactly what he said. And those institutions he's taking apart, whether it's the Department of Education, USAID, they have no connection to my life. And while, you know, that's certainly not true, Medicaid spending, you know, federal investments in research, et cetera, affects many communities, it was a point I really took seriously, which is their sense is it is not meant a material difference in my day-to-day life. And so if Trump and Musk say cutting this is going to cut costs, then I'm not going to stand in their way.
We're almost out of time. Arpana in San Jose, we don't have time to take your call, but thank you for the question. Arpana would like you to talk about the role that race and gender played into people who either changed their votes from Democrat to Trump or did not vote at all. Daniel, do you want to take that first?
Sure. I'll just say quickly, I mean, there is certainly a gender divide. You can see it clearly, especially in the Latino vote, but also to some extent in the African-American vote. I'll also say it's also not the only factor that's explaining these movements. It's not just an appeal to kind of patriarchy or it's also there's lots and lots of Latina women and Black women who are also trying to rethink these questions as well. So the other thing I just want to add is the Republican are attentive to identity. They have the Koch brothers invested in this big Latino outreach project called the Libre Network. And while sometimes it's uneven and sometimes it's kind of, you know, it feels performative, I think they're going to continue to make those investments in reaching and holding on to these new voters.
What are your thoughts on this, Tori?
Two key points. One is Trump is just very astute at using the Southern strategy. So this is the old Nixon strategy of divide and conquer, make people more fearful or angry at each other than, you know, the elite that are making it more difficult for their lives. So he creates these dividing lines, and people will often see themselves in the on the side of MAGA, even if they don't look like Trump, even if they're not as rich as the Trump family or not white like the Trump family, they get attracted to that vision of the world. So, you know, Democrats reverse engineering who they're fighting for, what they're going to do to fight for those folks is a way to inoculate on that Southern strategy. But the second point I wanted to make really quickly is, you know, Daniel just pointed to the Trump defectors. So these were the people that voted for Biden and have switched sides or had historically voted for a Democrat and voted for MAGA as being maybe less. There's a little bit of buyer's remorse, but feeling like they were satisfied so far with his actions. That same research is not true among the Biden skippers. So the Democrats that voted for Biden and stayed home, they are not curious about what MAGA's doing right now. They are very clear that Trump's actions harm them. They have a lot of regret about not voting the last time. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that Democrats can rest on their laurels. In fact, everything the callers have been saying about Democrats resting on their laurels for the last 30 some years and only pointing to, you know, civil rights gains are true. Democrats are going to have to proactively fight for them, but there is definitely more opening among those younger voters and voters of color and women who stayed home in the last cycle.
So Linda, you've been at this a long time. Final thoughts. We have about 30 seconds left.
I think that, and this is a personal opinion, I think everybody who wants change should be for campaign finance reform for the reasons that other people have talked about. And then I think that we should demand change, we should present change, and we should deliver on change.
Well, thank you all for your work. We have so many other emails that we couldn't get to, so we would love to have you back to continue this conversation. Celinda Lake is president of Lake Research Partners, a firm she founded in 1995. She's one of the Democratic Party's leading political strategists. She conducted her polling for the group Way to Win. Tori Gavito is president of Way to Win. It's a strategic donor collaborative. Daniel Martinez-Hosang is professor of American Studies and Political Science at Yale University. Check out his New York Times opinion piece, Inside the Rise of the Multiracial Right. It's such an important read. Find it at KALW.org, click news, and then your call, and you can learn more about Tori and Celinda's research. Daniel, Tori, and Celinda, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks to Johanna Miyake for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.